Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Raymond Luxury Yacht, it's spelled Luxury Yacht, I believe it's pronounced Throat Wobbler Mangrove, has supported Independent Tech News Directly for 5 years. Be like Raymond. Become a DTNS member at patreon.com/DTNS. This is the Daily Tech News for Friday, May 10th, 2019 in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
And from Studio Feline, I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm the show's producer, Roger Chang.
Joining us, the host of TechThing.com and AVXL, Mr. Patrick Norton, back on the show. Welcome back, Patrick.
Happy to be here.
I'm already looking forward to you telling us why a new $3,000 laptop doesn't perform as well as my 2-year-old laptop.
I brought props.
Nice. We will get
that's
to that.
Incentive to watch the video version.
It's nice. Yeah. We will get to that in a few moments, but let's start with a few tech things you should know.
Following on antitrust investigations in Europe and Russia, sources tell Reuters that the Competition Commission of India has ordered an investigation of whether or not Google abused its dominant position for Android in the Indian market. The investigation began after a complaint that Google blocked Android competitors, but it's unknown who filed the complaint.
Chinese e-commerce company JD reported its revenues grew 21% in Q1, which might sound good to you at first, but it's their slowest pace on record. Chinese companies are starting to reach a saturation point domestically and needing to find new markets to expand into. But JD in particular is also feeling pressure from several high-level staff departures and a lawsuit from a University of Minnesota student alleging rape against JD's CEO.
Google has rolled out the podcast-focused search results that it announced at Google I.O. Searching for a podcast now shows 3 most recent episodes, which can be played through a web player at podcast.google.com. Users signed in with a Google account can sync playback through the Google Podcast app.
And it works with Daily Tech News Show. I checked. Ooh. Google announced that all Chromebooks launched this year, Intel or ARM, will be Linux ready out of the box. Now, yes, Chrome OS is in fact built around the Linux kernel, but what they mean by this is you'll be able to run Debian from terminal. Type in terminal, you're running Debian. And with a few shell commands, you can do Ubuntu or Fedora as well. The Linux OS runs alongside the Chrome OS in these situations, meaning you can move your files between them.
Fascinating.
All right, let's talk a little more about the biggest news in tech stocks this year, or for a while, actually.
Yeah, this is a big one. Uber began trading stock on the New York Stock Exchange Friday under the ticker symbol Uber. The stock was issued at $45 per share, the low end of expectations. The stock finished at $41.55. Lyft stock, which, you know, is Uber's biggest competitor, has fallen more than 25% since its IPO in late March. Both Lyft and Uber tell investors that 2019 is their year of peak losses. Great year. That means the prices got to rise soon, right, as ridership is reaching a plateau. 85% of people in the U.S. use ride-hailing services rarely or never. Meanwhile, a study last year found that the services we're talking about at least, add 2.6 new vehicle miles for each mile that they lose. Last year, 24% of Uber's bookings came from Sao Paulo, London, New York, LA, and San Francisco.
Yeah, this changes everything, folks. Now that the ride-hailing companies, the two big ones in the U.S. anyway, and there are more around the world, we understand this, but the pressure is on for these companies to start making money. And it doesn't mean they have to turn a profit this year, but when they say peak losses this year, that means don't worry, investors, this is the worst it's going to get. We'll start reducing those losses pretty soon, and then we will eventually be profitable. But to do that, they need to have more people writing. 85% of the people in the U.S. not very, very often writing a service like this isn't good when you're going to have to face a price rise if you want to reach profitability. And the question, Sarah, I think is, can they survive into a more efficient system that is promised who knows when down the road, like driverless cars?
Yeah. And both Uber and Lyft have been public about their plans to be part of that revolution, but they've got a lot of competition. And, you know, when you say 85% of folks aren't using ride hailing services, I was also talking to an Uber driver when I was in San Francisco last week who lives in Sacramento, California, comes to San Francisco for like 5 days a month to make a bunch of money. And I said, well, why do you do that? Don't people like Uber in Sacramento? And he said, well, the drivers don't, because everyone's going downtown, but they live way out. And so you end up wasting a lot of gas because you're not getting fares coming back in. Certain cities just aren't set up for growth for either of these companies. So that's where Uber and Lyft, which is, I mean, the stock has taken quite a hit over, 2 months? So that's, you know, you're kind of like, all right, well, this is the model until we all go driverless. Let's call it 10 years from now. Yeah, what do these stock prices look like in 5 years?
It's amazing how disruptive you can be when you're spending somebody else's money against people that don't have somebody else's money to spend.
I mean, the idea was, you know, we're gonna lose money to gain ridership. And then once we get that ridership, we'll have people addicted. And then, you know, we can do what Netflix and Hulu and all those companies are doing, right? And start to slowly raise prices because everybody will rely on it. But there's a question of whether enough people are relying on this. And cities are actively, it's not even just about taxi drivers being upset or licensing problems. I mean, Derek Hosrashahi, let's give him credit, has done a great job of making Uber a better citizen with cities. But if you're adding 2.6 new vehicle miles for each mile you remove by giving someone a ride, you're making congestion worse, and that's going to make it hard for cities to want to cooperate with you.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see if scooters and public transit instructions, which is kind of their two big things that they're adding, will help with that. Microsoft Corporate Vice President Kevin Gallo wrote in a blog post this week, "You've told us that you would like us to continue to decouple many parts of the universal Windows platform so that you can adopt them incrementally. In other words, Microsoft is no longer trying to force developers into UWP. They don't have the phone anymore, which was kind of the big promise of UWP, because you could write an app once and it would work on whatever device. They still have HoloLens, they still have the Xbox, but Gallo told Mary Jo Foley of ZDNet, by the time we are done, everything will just be called Windows apps. Doesn't matter if it's Win32 or UWP or whatever. And don't get them wrong, Microsoft's not taking away UWP. Microsoft wants to make all developer features available to all the Windows frameworks. Gallo also said apps do not need to be in the store anymore. That was a point of contention for a while. And Paul Thurrott at Thurrott.com points out, this effectively means UWP as the one platform for all Windows apps is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't know. I feel bad for developers.
You feel bad for developers? This is giving the developers what they want.
Yes. I mean, I feel bad for developers who tried so hard to make UWP work and committed to products that were only available in the Microsoft Store, which many of us avoided assiduously. But I can also remember having a moment where I couldn't run the UDP version of Skype from the store, but I could run, it was just, if Microsoft with all of their development effort could have issues having, UWP apps function as well as standalone apps, what chance does a small shop or a smaller developer have?
The nice thing about this is Microsoft is taking a developer-friendly tack finally, right? But yeah, you're right.
Right.
It sucks that people either had to deal with this problem by not doing it and facing resistance from Microsoft, or pouring a lot of effort into doing it and now have Microsoft not pull the rug out from under them. Their UWP apps will still work, but feeling like, well, maybe I didn't have to spend all that time on
it. Yeah, the wording of it also is, it's very much like, you asked for it and we're delivering because we're Microsoft and we care.
Mm-hmm. I think
it's not wrong. No. I mean, it's purposeful language.
I will add, the one area that I will personally be affected is in the Xbox One homebrew community who were using UWP as a way to build essentially custom applications
And they'll still be able to. That's not going away. It's not going to hurt that.
Right.
They're not taking UWP away. Let's be very clear about that. They're just saying you don't have to use it anymore.
Earlier this week, add-ons for Firefox broke because of expired signing certificates. Mozilla CTO Eric Rescorla has posted a detailed explanation of how this happened, when they noticed it, and why it took as long as it did to fix it. The expired cert was noticed at 6 p.m. Pacific last Friday. A fix was shipped at 2:44 a.m., so just shy of 9 hours later. Part of the reason it took so long was security. Rescorla notes that Mozilla's own security protocols are good practice, but somewhat inconvenient if you want to issue a new certificate on an emergency basis. Rescorla talks about ways to prevent this from happening in the future, including better tracking of time-sensitive issues and better ways to securely push urgent updates. Patrick, I hear you laughing already. A full postmortem will be issued next week.
I'm just thinking of the number of times like certificates have gone out, or there've been a couple major websites where they've forgotten to pay, or nobody actually knew who had signed up for the original
right.
URL.
Where did the renewal email go? Yeah.
I mean, I had a conversation with somebody about that at a large organization I used to work for a few years ago. And they're like, well, at some point we really need to figure out how to pay for this, or just keep praying that the credit card keeps renewing each year. And I just remember being like, that's kind of big.
I mean, you know, that is the problem. Play hard. Is like, how did the certificate not get renewed? And he acknowledges that in this post. But if you get past that, this is a really fascinating post about, hey, folks, things aren't as easy as it looks. I know your add-ons didn't work and we should have renewed the certificate, but he very much explains why it took 9 hours. And I think makes a pretty good case why it had to take 9 hours if you want to do it right. And pointed out, like, we were following our own security protocols, and the better thing to do is not skimp on security protocols just because you want to get something done faster, especially when you're dealing with a security certificate. So
No. When people are in a hurry, you should just blow by all of the security protocols and all those checks and balances and all those laws and safety equipment. It'll all work out the way it's meant to.
So I think... This is great as an insight into the process for people who don't realize, like, oh, fixing this kind of stuff takes a long time. And there's good reasons why it takes a long time. And he's very transparent about what they did. It also doesn't try to let themselves off the hook that, like, we should have never been in this problem in the first place. We're going to work on that. We're going to make sure we have better tracking on our certificates. And I hope they do. I hope they figure all that stuff out.
Is anybody other than me just delighted when manufacturers or vendors or developers are actually like, we screwed up massively and we're really sorry about that? Is that just refreshing, or is it just me?
I think what's most refreshing about this is the detail, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just, oh, sorry. It's like, all right, let me explain what happened.
Right.
You know? I think
that's what I meant.
It's so refreshing because so many companies don't do that well enough, you know, where it's sort of like, all right, well, the problem went away, you know, and everyone's like, but we're still outraged.
Hey, we're really sorry, but apologies. It's all fixed now. Can you all go away? Thanks.
Where is our catharsis?
right. No, I think Mozilla's doing a good job of giving you catharsis without saying, you know, we didn't do anything wrong. I think they're owning up to it. Ars Technica's Ron Amadeo writes today that the Nest we knew is dead. So many things dying. Well, UWP isn't dying, but... there are definitely parts of Nest that are dying. Although Nest hasn't been an independent company since last year at Google I.O., this week Google Nest became the official rebrand. We talked about that on Tuesday. That means it's a Google smart home product. So like the Google Nest Protect, the Google Nest Secure Alarm System, Google Nest Hello. Chromecast didn't get rebranded yet. That'll be interesting. The Google Nest Cast, possibly. Anyway, a notice on Nest.com itself reads that Works with Nest is winding down. Now, we mentioned this on Tuesday, but we've had a few days to kind of wrap our heads around what this means. Works with Nest was the smart home platform that let your Nest thermostat or your drop cam or whatever work with a lot of other smart home products, usually using the thermostat as the hub. Now, Strategy will focus on the Works with Google Assistant program, which, as we noted Tuesday, has some more restrictions on how it uses data and what it can do, which is good. But the other side of this is that Nest's ecosystem is shutting down on August 31st, and The Verge notes that's going to affect Amazon, Philips Hue, IFT, Logitech Harmony, Lutron Lights, August Home, and Wemo switches, among others. Apparently, Google is working with Amazon to migrate the Nest skill to the Google Home, Google Assistant platform. So that may not end up being a problem, but all of these others will.
This is, I mean, I had a friend of mine who, I can't say that word. This is a family friendly podcast, who lost his collective stuff earlier this year because Iris shut down, and he had thousands of dollars of hardware and time invested in the, you know, the Iris, which was Lowe's competitor to mm-hmm. Home Depot's home automation system that I can't even remember the name of. There's this like 18 month span where they seem to kind of own the future before Google and Amazon stepped in. And, you know, we're seeing more and more of this where people have heavily invested in an ecosystem and it gets wiped out. And it, you know, the thing that, you know, we were thinking about on TechThing this week is like this whole relationship between Google and Nest has been kind of a hot mess.
It was spun out as an Alphabet company, which made perfect sense to me.
Right.
Alphabet saying, like, let's have a separate hardware company that can do other things. But then, you know, some people say it was because of the management. Other people say it was cold feet. They brought it back in under Google. And now it's just a product line under Google's hardware division. And
barely.
Yeah. It's gone. I mean, Nest itself is gone. Yeah.
This is essentially a zombie brand that mm-hmm. happens to have been fairly functional until, you know, it's not like the Polaroid television, you know, your dad picked up while he was at Walmart, but this is essentially they're
the
just
Nest
turning
name
into
has some good brand
familiar.
Recognition out there. So they want to keep using it on their Google products. Exactly. I imagine there will be more migration paths for some of these brands than it looks like right now, that there will be other ways to maybe even use Google Assistant to route through stuff to IFT and then get it back into your system. But it's going to require work no matter what. It's going to require people to do things like migrate accounts. Nest is going to require or at least highly encourage people to change their Nest accounts to Google accounts. And a lot of people aren't going to want to do that. Which means they're left with a zombie account that Google isn't saying they're going to shut down now, but it's not going to get any feature updates. It's only going to get security updates. So
I don't know. I'm kind of down with people moving off the Nest ecosystem in some ways because the Nest sort of back end because they had security issues. I'm also laughing because I'm looking at killedbygoogle.com and like waiting for Nest to pop up here, which probably isn't going to happen until August 31st.
Probably August
31st. If you've never been killed by Google.com, go there. It's gives you some real pause before you invest a lot in any hardware system owned by Google.
And Gadget reports that Lyft is experimenting with longer-term car rentals to a test of customers in San Francisco. Lyft confirmed the program and said, "We're currently testing a small-scale rental option for long-distance trips, like a weekend away. Testers will pay about $60 a day for a standard sedan and around $100 a day for an SUV. Renters will be able to claim up to $20 in Lyft credit for a ride to a Lyft rental car lot, which at least right now is based in San Francisco's Mission District, from wherever they are at the time."
I find this pricey. Roger and I were kind of trying, going around earlier to try to decide if with fees and stuff, is this really pricey? Roger, I know you think it's a fair amount. I still think it's kind of high. Right now,
$100 a day.
If you go look
for an SUV
right now on Travelocity, you can get it for $66 a day with the fees and stuff. That's probably more like $75. But
In San Francisco,
at SFO,
aren't they running a 19% saving, charging back the? It depends on where you rent it, I guess. But
my question was like, that's an all-in price, right? Once you pay that, you're not paying additional taxes. You're not paying additional.
You're not paying
insurance,
the airport fee, any of that.
To me, I mean, even if it was $15 or $20 differential per day, it's still, I mean, if you're only going to use the car a few days, I would totally go for it because you don't need to worry about the rest of it. You don't have to worry about getting your car back to Enterprise or whomever. And once you drop it off, you just take a Lyft back to the airport.
And they're giving you credits for that. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
now they're competing with people like me who use GetAround to rent out our cars. Upstanding citizens who just want to make a buck when they don't drive for days on end because they work from home. So thanks a lot, Lyft. I know this is just a test in San Francisco, but if it's successful, it's gonna creep outward.
Well, and I'm sure the get around prices are lower than this, right? I assume they are.
Yeah. Well, you can set your price.
Yeah.
So for my car, I could say you pay me $100 a day. My car is technically an SUV. But,
yeah. You could say 95 and then undercut left, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a whole sort of system of, you know, you kind of want to just like undercut the other person who has the same model car as you. But again, if you are a faithful Lyft user and they've got this option and you're like, oh, I want to go to wine country for the weekend. Let's just use Lyft. We already use Lyft. Well, they're going to do well then.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have to pay for a lift out to the airport. You wouldn't have to deal with the airport at all. That's a nice convenience. I still think it's a little pricey, but maybe it's not that bad all in. You guys have started to convince me. Folks, if you want to get all the tech headlines each day in about 5 minutes, be sure to subscribe to DailyTechHeadlines.com. Patrick recently did a review of the IdeaPad S940, and I know, Patrick, it got you thinking. Why a laptop like that, which costs around $3,000 and has a faster CPU, got beat in your performance test by a laptop with an older, slower processor?
Yeah, this has been interesting for me. A friend of mine bought a $3,000 laptop about, I don't know, a year ago, 18 months ago. It was passively cooled, i.e. there was no fans inside of it. And the idea that he was going to have this magnificent Core i7, high power, extraordinarily in it. He had a 1 terabyte hard drive. He had, you know, 32 gigabytes of memory. It was maxed out. And he put it next to his existing computer, you know, and starts transferring things and start using it. And even in day-to-day use, it was miserable. As in, imagine, you know, it, like, remember when you went home and you used your dad's computer and he hadn't updated it in like 5 years before you left home? You left home 5 years ago. Uh-huh. And he uses it for checkers on Yahoo, so he doesn't really notice anything, but you try to launch a web page and it takes 3 days. It was not quite that bad using this brand new $3,000 laptop. But it was astonishingly bad in day-to-day, like opening browser. Like literally, there were moments where there were like 15 browser windows or 15 browser tabs open and type was lagging as you tried to type into a document. If you actually try to do any real work, I just remember being blown away because this brand new Core i7 system side by side with a 2-year-old Core i5 laptop that cost half as much new, the Core i5 laptop, this Dell XPS 13, was absolutely smoking it. And we started to realize, as we started using some tools to look at, we started to realize that, you know, the laptop was quickly becoming thermally saturated. And what happens is, if this is a good thing for the most part, right? Back in the day, you could manage to generate so much heat in your processor that you could literally fry your processor. Roger and I could tell you stories. Tom would point and laugh and join in, except that he probably already always adequately cooled his processors. But it gets really frustrating because laptops are designed, especially as they get thinner and thinner and thinner, there's this idea of a TDP or thermal design power, and most laptops are like 15 watt, 45 watt, or 90 watt. 90 watts are the big, like, lunch tray size gaming laptops. An XPS 13, the S940, most of the ultra portables, they're probably running like a 15 watt TDP, which means all of the computing power has to basically fit inside of that 15 watt space. And in theory, you know, processors may go up to 150% of TDP in some situations, but fundamentally, how well your processor performs is directly related to how good a job your hardware does cooling it. And, you know, I was teasing Tom, like, I have props, but, you know, this is a very small, like 37 millimeter Noctua cooler that's designed for low profile cases. Like, you know, I have this very cool case. It's very small, and this is going to go inside of it. This is, you know, by the time you get to a 95 watt desktop processor, this is maxed out. And it's probably, if you're doing things that generate a ton of heat, like you're rendering video, you're using all 8 cores of your processor, that tends to saturate the device. Like, heat kind of builds up, and then first the processor gets hot, then the cooler gets hot, then the area around the case gets hot, then everything inside the case gets hot, which is why you would use, you know, a bigger cooler. And a bigger cooler is, guess what, going to pull more heat away. But you can't fit a bigger cooling system inside of a laptop. So it gets really interesting when you start looking at roughly the same processor in two different laptops, and you find out the performance can be astonishingly different off of parts that are technically the same. Well, the parts are the same, but you're either going to enable them or hinder their performance by how well a job you do cooling them. Because if things get too hot, the clock speed turns down. And if they don't cool off enough, then the clock speed turns down some more, and then the clock speed turns down some more. And then eventually you're looking at,
spending all day waiting for something to happen.
Is that something the processor does on its own as self-defense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The processor, it's really amazing. Because that also allows things to happen like, okay, they will max out the threads. It also makes it, there's a lot of really cool stuff in the way thermal management's going on right now with CPUs, especially some of the stuff going on with the Ryzen processors where they're literally measuring temperatures, taking thermals all over the chip and adjusting things on the fly to try to figure out how to keep everything running, to kind of balance out, making everything run as fast as possible. But yeah, literally what happens, the processor gets to a certain temperature and it's like, no. And then it, turns down the clock speed, and that should drop the amount of heat being generated. And then it'll try to turn it up, and it'll eventually, if you add more cooling, then it'll be able to run maxed out at the highest possible CPU speed. But if you don't have enough cooling, it slows down. And we've been noticing this a lot, me and some of the guys at PCPer and a couple other places, where we're looking at devices and being like, this is awesome. Oh my goodness, this is really bad for certain workloads.
It's so quiet and it got real slow because, is it that these quiet cooling systems, these fanless cooling systems just aren't capable of that, or is it vary by implementation?
It varies a lot by implementation. I will say flat out, period, physics, is a hard wall. Mm. And when you get, as things get thinner and thinner and thinner, and you have less space inside the enclosure to work with, moving the heat off of the processor and getting it outside of the laptop gets harder and harder. We've also seen things like, I wouldn't be surprised, for example, in the case of this IdeaPad, like I wouldn't be surprised if they made some tweaks to it to make the fan louder, basically to make the fan run faster, which you hear as being louder, but will also make it more effective at removing heat from the processor. Mm-hmm. They changed from generation to generation. There's some crazy stuff that Dell did with the materials they used to sort of isolate the heat inside the laptop and make it move out. But mostly it comes down to figuring out how to move more air. Like one of the biggest things, 1,000 years ago on desktops is they figured out like, smaller fans running faster move the same amount of air as larger fans moving slower, but larger fans moving slower make a lot less noise. And it's something to look at. I will also point out that in terms of everyday computing, it's only a rare edge case where somebody has really done a piss poor job of matching the thermals to the processor where you run into noticeable things. Where it starts becoming really noticeable is if you are like rendering video, doing a bunch of processing in Photoshop, or doing some kind of crazy, if you're a programmer and you're compiling giant amounts of code where you max out the processor and leave it there for a long time.
Does it matter? Most people have a hot room?
Don't do that. It doesn't help.
No, I know it doesn't help. I'm just wondering how much of an effect that really has. Because I think that could be exaggerated, maybe.
I think it can be exaggerated a lot, but it also depends on a hot room near the equator or a hot room in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Arizona, Amazon, or Cleveland, Toronto, Moosehead, Moose Jaw, something like that.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. And of course, if you want to find that review, where should they go?
TEKTHING.com tech thing.
You know who else is hot? In fact, they're on fire. All the people who participate in our subreddit. You can submit stories and vote on others at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/groups/dailytechnewsshow.
The sub is on fire.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe we should just check the mailbag.
Let's do it. Anthony, who's a licensed real estate agent, he says, for about 5 years in the state of Vermont, wrote in about our discussion on Redfin Direct. That was in yesterday's show. And some of our questions about how this could affect the real estate market going forward. One of Anthony's thoughts, and thank you for the long, thoughtful email, Anthony, was, I wonder how Redfin is going to handle a lot of the legalities of real estate. In my state, you have to have a license to deal in real estate. One of the prerequisites is that you need to sit under somebody for 2 years and complete 8 transactions. I wonder how Redfin is going to handle that. What I really wonder is how they're going to navigate the laws and nuances of all 50 states. Every state is different. They're going to need an army of lawyers to make this work nationwide.
Well, the good news for Redfin is they already do this. They already sell houses. They have agents. You can actually get agents through Redfin. So I imagine they're covered for most of these concerns just under the stuff, the work that they had to do to have agents in various markets. But it's a good question because they do need to have different compliance for different states, and they are trying to work in as many states as possible. So it's a very good question, Anthony. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Anthony. And also thanks to Patrick Norton for being with us on this wonderful Friday. Patrick, where can people find all the great stuff you do?
Well, techthing.com or avxl.com. AVXL is the podcast I host with Robert Herron. We talk about audio and video and home theater and speakers and screens and stuff. And of course, Tech Thing is the podcast I host with Shannon Morse.
There has never been a better time to be a DTNS member because live with it. The first episode is out. Sarah told us all about her 3 months living with the Jabra 65T Elite headphones or earbuds. And it's in your Patreon feed right now. If you haven't noticed it,
go look.
Yeah. It's good stuff. And we're doing the vote right now. We're probably going to wrap it up today on what the.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Right now on a special edition of Tools and Weapons, Brad Smith is sharing a vision for what Microsoft calls the new AI economy. It's an idea rooted in technological revolutions of the past, like the printing press, which created a vibrant marketplace of related innovations, ultimately leading to an explosion of books and readers. But he doesn't just give a history lesson. In the episode, Brad lays out the tangible ways that Microsoft is providing infrastructure and other support to those leading the charge of the new AI economy. And he explains the importance of using that infrastructure to ensure equitable access to AI to people all over the world. To stay current on insights from voices at the center of the conversation on AI, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you like to listen.
Next product should be, that's a little farther back, I think back on May 7th in your Patreon feed. But if you're like, oh, wait, I don't get any of that. I'm not a Patreon. You can fix that real easy. Just head to patreon.com/DTNS.
And if you have feedback for us, we'd love to read them. Our email address is feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. Or if you see me on the street, just tell me in person. But that's probably the better way to do it. We're live Monday through Friday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can find out more and tell a friend at dailytechnewsshow.com/live.
Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you Monday.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.